With that, we're ready to hear argument in Morales Cabarra versus Corin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jason Wasoki, bar number 34241, on behalf of Mr. Morales Cabarra. One of the potential jurors in this case, juror number 12, unequivocally identified herself as somebody who could not be fair, unbiased, and impartial. She should have been stricken for cause. However, the trial judge did not strike her for cause. That was an abuse of discretion that under binding precedent requires reversal. This court did ask us to address the Novotny case, which I will do at the outset. I think our briefing sets forth very clearly why and how the judge abused his discretion in not striking juror number 12, and the reasons why that results in reversible error. The question the court asked was, what implications does Novotny have on this case? And the short answer, Your Honors, is none. The Novotny case overturned McCrander, which is a criminal case. And McCrander is different from the case that binds this court, which is Blades versus Defoe. They are two different sets of laws, two different sets of rules, and that is civil and criminal. And Blades versus Defoe is a civil case that the Colorado Supreme Court decided in 1985. In deciding Blades versus Defoe, the Supreme Court reached back all the way to 1909 to basically reaffirm what is now over a century of precedent, demonstrating in the civil arena that a failure to strike a juror for cause, who should have been stricken for cause, when that is an abuse of discretion, automatic reversal is warranted. And that's an important distinction, because when Novotny overturned McCrander, what Novotny essentially did is it reinstated the harmless error review established in 1975 by the Silvola case, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And in the Silvola case, what happened was the Colorado Supreme Court said that in order to obtain reversal when a court abuses its discretion in not striking a juror for cause, is that litigant must show prejudice. That is exactly what the Novotny court reinstated just a little while ago. And that's an important point, because what happened with McCrander is that the Colorado Supreme Court overturned the harmless error analysis. In Blades versus Defoe, however, the Colorado Supreme Court didn't overturn the harmless error analysis. In fact, it reaffirmed what was then nearly a century of precedent requiring automatic reversal in the civil arena for abuse of discretion when a court fails to strike a juror for cause.
But counsel, wasn't McCrander also based on that same century-old civil precedent?
It was in part, Your Honor. However, it's important to note that Blades looked at two separate cases. McCrander looked at the Denver Tramway case, which is also a civil case, whereas Blades looked at the Grand Lodge, which is a 1909 case, a metallic gold mine. But I'd submit to Your Honors that because Blades was founded on almost a century-old case law, and in fact McCrander was based on civil case law from over a century ago, that only reaffirms the importance of the automatic reversal rule in the civil arena. And the reason why it reaffirms it and why it's important is that the concerns that the Supreme Court had in Novotny simply don't exist in the civil arena. Basically, those are two things. One is the high cost, according to the Novotny court, of automatic reversal in the criminal arena. That simply doesn't exist in the civil arena. The reason being is that in the criminal arena, you have obviously an appeal as of right. There are many more appeals in the criminal arena than in the civil arena. And in the criminal arena, this automatic reversal for failure to strike a juror for cause is one of the, if not the most important arrows in a defense attorney's quiver. And Your Honors probably have much more familiarity than I do, but I wouldn't be surprised if one of the cases on today's docket brought that issue about. When I did do...
But counsel, you seem to be arguing against the application of the harmless error rule in all civil cases, because it doesn't cost that much to have a retrial.
Not quite, Your Honor. I'm arguing against it in this situation where a substantial right, such as the use of a peremptory strike, is taken away from a litigant. And nowhere in the Novotny case, and for decades if not centuries, the Colorado Supreme Court has reaffirmed the notion that a peremptory strike is a substantial right afforded to litigants. And when a substantial right is taken away, that is why the automatic reversal rule set out in Blades versus Defoe exists. And the Novotny court did not overturn that and did not say that we think a peremptory strike is not a substantial right.
Mr. Wysocki, if you're right, wouldn't it be anomalous that civil litigants would apparently have more rights than defendants in criminal cases with regard to this issue?
I don't think it would be anomalous, and I don't think they'd be afforded more rights. I think it simply comes down to a standard of review. The Novotny court was concerned with the concept of structural error, which in a few rare circumstances, but almost never applies in the civil arena. It would apply, for example, a Batson challenge was made to a civil jury. But absence of structural error, which is really what the Novotny case is all about, when you read that case closely, Your Honors, basically what the Colorado Supreme Court says is that we don't think the failure to have a peremptory strike rises to the level of structural error. And when you examine the case law that establishes structural errors, those are all criminal court errors.
Well, even though structural error is limited to criminal cases, I think it's also true that harmless error is applied frequently in civil cases. And is there any other situation of which you're aware in a civil case that where an error leads to automatic reversal?
If there were similar structural errors in a civil matter.
Except, there are no structural errors in civil cases, we're just saying.
No, that's not true. It rarely occurs in civil cases. For example, if you had a biased judge, if you had a jury that was challenged for Batson reasons and it ultimately turned out that that jury should have been redone or however the Batson challenge, that would be essentially a structural error in the civil arena resulting in automatic reversal. But you are correct, Judge Taubman, that basically in the civil arena, harmless error does apply, but that applies to evidentiary issues.
And I'm sort of confused by your answer. So you believe that structural error also exists in the civil context. And if that's the case, shouldn't Novotny be even more on point to this case? Because Novotny tells us that this sort of error in denying and failing to grant a challenge for cause is not structural error. So why, if it's not structural error in criminal cases, why should it be structural error in civil cases?
I'm not arguing whether or not it should be structural error in civil cases. What I'm saying is that in civil cases, based on the Blades versus Defoe precedent, which binds this court, in the civil arena, a challenge for cause that is denied should, but then the court abuses its discretion, that should result in automatic reversal.
But not because it's structural error, because it's some other kind of error that warrants automatic reversal.
Correct. It's the taking away of a substantial right, which the Novotny court did not disagree with. I would actually submit that the Novotny court reaffirmed the concept of a substantial right. And it's different in the criminal context as well. And this is where Blades versus Defoe explicitly rejected the harmless error analysis when it said, in the civil arena, a litigant must use all of his or her peremptory strikes, whereas in the criminal arena, that is not the case. So because the peremptory strikes must be used in the civil arena, the harmless error analysis, the prejudice analysis simply doesn't apply. But what's also important...
I'm not sure what you mean. When you say they must use all of their challenges, you're saying in order to get reversal in the civil context?
No, in the civil context, the rules require that a litigant use all four peremptory strikes in order to whittle the jury down to six jurors or a seventh alternate.
Okay, go ahead.
So what's also important for this court to understand with regard to Novotny is that that case can only be applied prospectively.
Just a minute.
Yes.
The commentators, which to this point include only the author of the syllabus and the headnotes of West, suggest that Denver Tramway has been overruled. If that is true, doesn't that undercut Blades?
I don't think so, because Blades versus Defoe doesn't rely or cite to Denver Tramway. It relies on two completely separate cases. And so if Denver Tramway is overruled, I think that follows from the McCrander case, but I don't think it affects Blades versus Defoe. And Your Honor, what I think this court has to do in this case is adhere to Blades versus Defoe, and then let the Supreme Court hash that out as it wishes. But because Blades versus Defoe is binding precedent on this court, That requires reversal and remand.
And you're suggesting Blades is binding on this court even if the court implicitly overruled Denver Tramway?
Yes, because Denver Tramway has nothing to do with Blades versus Defoe. Blades versus Defoe comes from a different line of precedent that relies on different cases. Sometimes one might argue that the facts are similar, but they are different cases. I think there's the distinctions with differences.
So you're saying they're a different line of cases. So
yes.
none of the cases relied on by Blades cited Denver Tramway.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And Blades had nothing to do with peremptory challenges, except that the judge misconstrued Rule 47 and gave the defendants more peremptory challenges than they were entitled to.
It did not
involve the denial of a motion to strike, challenge for cause to a prospective juror.
That was one part of the case, Your Honor. However, I believe it's Section 4 of the Blades opinion talks actually about challenge for cause to a prospective juror. So there were two aspects to that opinion, Your Honor. You are correct that in one respect, Blades did interpret the allocation of peremptories under 47. That was one part of the opinion. However, the last part of the opinion speaks specifically to the challenge for cause based on potential bias under 47E7.
But that was not involved in Blades.
It was involved, Your Honor.
Well, the court didn't deny challenges in Blades. That's not the issue of Blades.
In Blades, on page 324, the court says, where there's sufficient reason to believe that at the beginning of the trial, the prospective juror is not indifferent, the juror must be dismissed for cause. The trial, and then it continues on towards the end of the opinion, the trial court's error in failing to dismiss Mrs. D required the plaintiffs to exercise one of their peremptory challenges to excuse her from a jury, and peremptory challenges are substantial rights not intended as a remedy for trial court errors. So getting back to the issue of whether or not Novotny could even be applied in this case, it can only be applied prospectively. And the Chevron three-part...
In Novotny itself, they applied the rule retrospectively to the trial in Novotny that happened before they changed the rule in Novotny.
That, Your Honor, is unknown. My understanding of the Novotny case from reading the briefs and listening to the arguments is that issue was raised and argued, and the court simply punted on the issue, and that being hashed out.
But if they agreed with you that it was only prospective, they would have affirmed the Court of Appeals decision, which reversed the conviction under the old rule. So if the old rule still applied because the new rule only applies prospectively, they would have affirmed the Court of Appeals.
It was remanded to the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, for a harmless error analysis. That's
right,
correct.
Which is the new rule. So they applied the new rule to a case that had been tried before the new rule was announced. That's not consistent with only prospective application.
Okay. My understanding, Your Honor, is that the issue of retroactive and retrospective application is being hashed out right now in these courts, but you certainly would know better than I would. So I'll move on to one other point, Your Honors, with regard to the issue. If this court does apply Novotny, which I don't think it should, this is not a harmless error. We can look to a few different things. First of all, we can look again at the voir dire transcript. And there are two jurors. We challenged three jurors for cause. There are five jurors that demonstrated bias during questioning. And juror number 11, Ms. Vieira, and juror number 3, Ms. Katie, indicated, one said they wouldn't give money for impairment, they wouldn't give punitives. Another one agreed and wouldn't buy it that the heart attack was caused by stress, and she'd have to be pretty convinced. So we think, Your Honor, under a harmless error analysis, that this is non-harmless error. These two jurors demonstrated bias. We were down to our last strike, and we had to pick the lesser of two evils, and we struck Miss Katie. We left Miss Vieira on the jury, and she...
Did you strike the latter juror, or did you challenge the latter juror for cause?
Miss Vieira?
Yes.
No, we did not, Your Honor.
So then why should we presume there's any problem with that jury if you didn't bother to strike or challenge her for cause?
Because under the Martinez-Salazar case, which is U.S. Supreme Court 528-304, There is no, the question is whether or not the jury consisted of a biased juror.
Right, and this juror was not so biased that you even bothered to challenge her for cause, so why should we have any concerns about her?
I see my time is up.
Please, you can answer the question.
Sure. Your Honor, I think it's a non-harmless error for the reasons previously stated, but because Ms. Vieira demonstrated bias, because we had already attempted to get through various questions with the jury, and what the court said in the middle of our questioning of Ms. Katie, because we were only given 30 minutes for voir dire, I'm sorry, counsel, you only have a few moments left, before we were able to exhaust our inquiry of Ms. Katie to basically establish a challenge for cause, then we were cut off.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Robin Averback, bar number 31020. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Corin. I believe before we address the Novotny case and the application to the case at hand, what we represent to the court is that you never have to get to Novotny in this case. When you look at what happened at the trial court level, there was no abuse of discretion. Judge Hyatt had a basis for dismissing Ms. Anderson from the panel. And I think it's important that this court looks at the appellate record and in particular the questioning of the jury. The briefs at issue in this case, I believe, misrepresent the questions that were asked of Ms. Anderson and also state repeatedly that she repeatedly said she couldn't apply, that she wouldn't follow the judge's instructions, she couldn't follow the burden of proof. What I ask is that you look at the actual exchange in question, which was on page 71 of the transcript of the voir dire. And the actual exchange that was the only thing that could form a basis for the challenge of cause does not demonstrate a basis for removing Ms. Anderson from the panel. It was a lengthy question by Mr. Morales' counsel that began with the premise that this case involved a heart attack that happened 2.5 months earlier. It was prefaced with, you're gonna hear doctors giving you different testimony. And she was asked whether she would be able to find for the plaintiff in this case if it was slightly more, if it was proved that the heart attack was slightly more likely caused by the crash. This was following the discussion of the doctors and the different testimony she was going to hear on medical causation. Her question, her response was, in a case like that, where it is, where it could be totally, and then it was inaudible. The briefing says we're just missing a word. We have no idea what we're missing, and I'm going to point out that later in the record we're missing a whole statement by another juror, and I'm going to point out in the record why there was more than a word missing from there. You have the inaudible section, and then counsel says, I'm sorry, I think you said it would have to be totally proven. She doesn't agree with that. She doesn't say, yes, it would have to be totally proven. What she says is proof that it happened 2 months later. Again, we have an inaudible section of her testimony. She says, I'd have a hard time saying, oh, you're kind of more right. And then counsel says, if we prove in your words, kind of more right, without clarifying what she meant by kind of more right, that the heart attack was caused by the crash, would you be able to find that the heart attack was caused by the crash in our favor? Which she does say no.
Well, what else could she have meant besides kind of more right? Doesn't that mean more likely than not that the heart attack was caused by the crash?
And I'm going to get to that, Your Honor. I think I will answer that question directly if you just let me finish two more sentences of
okay.
This. I promise you I'll answer that question.
Okay.
He says, okay, Mr. Morales' counsel says, okay, sounds like a pretty strong opinion. Is there anything that I could say that would change your opinion? Probably not. That's what the counsel says, not Ms. Anderson. Ms. Anderson doesn't say, you're right, you probably can change my mind. What she says is, if he was like, okay, this doctor has 5 notes that say it probably wasn't, but your doctor has 6, I don't know. So we're left with, I don't know. But we have all these inaudible sections, we don't know what it is. But what I think is telling about the transcript is, what does Mr. Morales' counsel ask next? He asks the panel, who agrees with what Ms. Anderson said? A juror, Mr. Zatt, raises his hand. He says, I do. And he says, the same. I would submit to this court, the same means this is the same as what Ms. Anderson said.
Which
he says,
what?
The same thing. I would want to know ahead of time, before, if he had any conditions that led to the heart attack. What I believe was discussed was, are there other conditions? What they were talking about is medical causation. If you have a doctor with 5 records that says it was and 6 that says it wasn't, there's other factors. What was Mr. Morales' condition before? Because there's a 2.5-month gap.
Counsel, these records are not perfect, and particularly the ones that are recorded are not perfect. But don't we have to live with them? And didn't the trial court and defense counsel have an ample opportunity to clarify all that you're trying to clarify now?
Your Honor, they did, but what I submit to this court is they didn't need to. Judge Hyatt clarified it when he said that those two jurors said they would listen to the evidence and be fair. We have inaudible sections that would make sense. That is a section where that was discussed.
But the record as it is before us does not, in our view, support that finding, then where are we left?
Well, Your Honor, then we would get to the case law on point. And I think there is I was actually going to point out the large distinction between civil and criminal cases. When you look at the automatic reversal, it's in criminal cases, someone is potentially being denied life, potentially being denied liberty.
Excuse me, before you get into that, Ms. Averbach, I wanted to go back and ask you about the omissions or the inaudible parts of the transcript. You say that, you know, the other side is at fault for just having presented a record that has omissions, and yet the other side says on page 17 of its reply brief that it was your obligation to supplement the record under CAR 10 if you didn't think that what was presented was sufficient. What is your take on that?
Well, Your Honor, I think there can be no supplementing the record for those missing parts. We had one court reporter, we had one recording, so there was one ability to get that transcript. If things didn't make it to the recording, we can't go back in time and recreate it. I think...
Well, yes, you can, because CAR 10 does provide for when there's no transcript at all or in lieu of a transcript, it provides for the parties to provide a summary of what was otherwise taking place in the trial court. So presumably the same could have been done for this part of the voir dire.
It could have, Your Honor. However, without going back in time, we can't say for certainty what was said. All we can rely on is what Judge Hyatt recalled the juror said as part of the record he made when she was challenged for cause. And I think it's an analogous to the case law that says when there's no record at all, the duty falls to the appellant. And in that type of case, this case, it's the same as having no record, because the part we're missing is the actual only part of the record we need is the discourse between appellant's counsel and the juror at question. That's the only part that we have that's inaudible.
Well, they did provide a certified record. What are they required to do beyond that?
Your Honor, I would submit that the record would need to be complete. If you're going to challenge a juror and go through and pick out part of their testimony, if we can't hear everything she said, and we have Judge Hyatt, who remembers hearing her state she'd be impartial, we have defense counsel who said the same thing on record, I believe that it's a high deference that's given to the judge in these type of cases.
So we only give great credence to what the trial judge says when there's some support for it in the record. And there is no support for that in this record.
Your Honor, I think that there is...
Well, you do argue that in the early parts of the voir dire, the jury was asked generally, will you follow the instructions? Do you understand your obligations?
Right.
And nobody raised their hand and said no. Or we've all been through voir dires, something akin to that. But doesn't this trump those general questions that were made at the beginning of the entire panel, typically by the court?
I have two responses to this. There was the general ones to the court at the beginning, Your Honor, and then Mr. Latchley, on behalf of the defense, Ms. Corrin, asked a very specific question to the entire panel at the end with the same thing. You've heard conflicting testimony about the heart attack. How many of you are going to have a problem? Is anyone going to have a problem awarding a verdict in this case because of that? So the heart attack was addressed after this exchange. And I think this exchange is much more close to People O'Neill, where a juror was saying, you know, he was having issue with the burden of proof and saying, well, I think...
Are you saying there's some statement by this juror later in the voir dire that clarifies what occurred in this section of the record?
There's no other statements by this juror in the record, Your Honor, but she did not respond when asked if she would have a problem with the heart attack issue by Mr. Lachalet, which occurred later. And I know the Clemens case came down that said silence would not constitute a rehabilitation, but the dissent in that case raised several valid points that I think are right on this case, because Ms. Anderson obviously was willing and able to wave her hand and offer testimony, which she did when she felt she needed to respond to two earlier questions. So we don't have a case where a juror who's not willing to talk.
So in order to agree with your position, do we have to disagree with Clemens?
I don't think you have to disagree with Clemens. I think Clemens is distinguishable. It involves a
defendant. Well, I was intrigued by your immediate reference to the dissent, so I assume you wanted us to follow the dissent.
Well, I wouldn't want you to follow the dissent, but I do think the case is distinguishable because it involves the Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights of a defendant that were put at issue. In that case, jurors were saying, we are not going to give you the presumption of innocence. We are going to require you to testify, which I think is different than the case we have at hand. I'm getting close to time, so I would like to address Novotny, because it sounds like the...
I would suggest you do that.
The court would like me to do that. I believe Novotny is exactly on point. It mandates that we have to look at this as a harmless error standard. I was not prepared to argue about Blades setting a different standard. Blades relies on previous criminal law. I can't see a context where civil litigants should be afforded greater protection and have an automatic new trial versus criminal defendants who have life and liberty at stake. So I cannot imagine that the Supreme Court intended to have a different standard. And when you look at, just briefly was looking at Blades, there's numerous references to criminal proceedings. I think that the case law in Novotny is going to be equally binding.
In Novotny, do you think Novotny explicitly overruled the case law applying to civil cases?
I do.
Where is the explicit overrule of civil cases?
There is no explicit overrule of civil cases, but just like all the cases that were argued in this, in the briefs in this case, in the civil arena, we're forced to look to criminal cases for guidance. We rely on them, we cite to them, and again, I think the greater protection...
If you agree that the court in Novotny did not explicitly overrule these civil cases, what authority do we have as a court of appeals to ignore those earlier civil cases from the Supreme Court?
I think the authority you have is that Novotny would be binding precedents on the civil case. I think it was an oversight that it wasn't addressed, because I can't imagine that it didn't go through and say
we've gotten in a lot of trouble saying that the Supreme Court engaged in oversight. Yeah. Well, we sort of avoid saying that the Supreme Court did not see the issue.
Yeah, I agree.
You can understand our reluctance, can you not?
I realize that was probably a poor choice of words. But I think that you're looking at constitutional rights when you look at defendants in criminal cases that are at issue. You don't have those same rights that are at issue in civil cases, so why would a civil litigant be afforded a greater right to a new trial for as a matter of right?
It is an enigma, isn't it?
But even if we agree with you that what you're saying makes sense, again, the question is, are we allowed to decide not to follow a state Supreme Court case because we think it doesn't make sense anymore?
Yeah. I have never, if I came in here and said you didn't have to follow any of the cases that were cited in the briefing because it was a criminal case, I think you would tell me that that's not true, that it's binding law and it's precedent upon you, that there's no set distinction between criminal and civil cases, that binding law is binding law. What Novotny stands for, it doesn't say it's just standing for the criminal arena. It says if a...
Well, it does identify the cases it's overruling, and they're both criminal cases.
Ms. Averbeck, let me ask you as a follow-up to my colleague's questions. Do you think that the Novotny decision implicitly overruled Blades v. Defoe?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see how there can be any other interpretation of it.
Is there some standard that you would cite to us for how we determine whether a case has been implicitly overruled by the Supreme Court?
Your Honor, I've not had the opportunity to research that because, again, this wasn't briefed. This case is new, and I didn't realize that argument would be made today, but I would venture to guess there probably is, and I would be glad to file a surreply or supplement the briefing in some way to address that issue. And what I think the issue in to address the Novotny case to the extent it's determined it is applicable to this case at hand, I think there's no basis that the cases that follow in the U.S., the U.S. cases that follow say if the juror use a peremptory challenge, you get the biased juror off, there can be no prejudice. There was no challenges to cause for any of the jurors left on the panel, and there was no request for extra peremptory challenges, which a party can make. It's up to the judge's discretion if he wants to afford extra peremptory challenges, and that request wasn't made. And as we know, to preserve something for appeal, you must make an appropriate objection at the trial level, which wasn't made to the jurors. Ms. Vieira, I believe, was a juror that appellate said he would have taken off the panel had he had that opportunity. And again, turning to Blades' case, even if it were applicable, I think this case is also distinguishable because it's not the same. You're dealing with an inherent bias and an enmity to the plaintiff in that case, or the defendant in that case, which we didn't have at this case. When you look at the exchange between Ms. Anderson, it doesn't rise to the level of what occurred in Blades. So I think that case would also be distinguishable just on that basis. But the position of the appellee in this case is that Novotny is applicable, that...
Okay, thank you, counsel. I think we got your argument. Okay, thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.